Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In today's first hour, we'll be talking with Rory Stewart. He is, among other things, a travel writer. He's written for New York Times Magazine, Granta, the London Review of Books. He's also written about politics, perhaps much more about politics than about travel. Back in 2002, just months after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, he set out to walk across the country. It was at this time the middle of winter. Some of the territory that he would cross was still held by the Taliban. There were wolves. In fact, he was told at least by one person in no uncertain terms that he would not survive. He did, however, and he has told the story in a book that's gotten a lot of positive reviews that is out now in paperback. The book is titled The Places in Between, and it's published by Harcourt. He also has authored a newer book that is now out in hardcover, also by Harcourt, that talks about his experiences in the post-war reconstruction of Iraq. The book is titled The Prince of the Marshes. That's the version that we have on this side of the ocean. The subtitle is Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq. In addition to his experience taking long walks, he also has served in the British military and also in the British Foreign Service. And we'll try to talk a little bit about both of these stories this morning in this part of Focus 580. Possibility of calling in is there. Certainly, if you'd like to call in, you have questions, comments for our guest, 333-9455, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, toll-free 800-222-9455. That one will be good if you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, if it would be a long-distance call. Actually, if even people listening on the Internet in the United States can use that one. So that's 800-222-9455 and the local 333-9455. Our guest is also a former fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was awarded the Order of the British Empire by the British government for his services in Iraq. He makes his home in Scotland, and he talks with us from there. Mr. Stewart, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The obvious first question, and I'll ask it in two parts. First, perhaps, quite obviously, you're drawn to this part of the world and its people and its cultures. And I know that you speak Dari, which is one of the languages of the region. What is it about this part of the world, about West Asia, that so fascinates you?
I grew up in Asia. I was born in Hong Kong and grew up in Malaysia. And in a sense, flying back and forth from where my parents lived in Malaysia and Hong Kong and where I was educated in Britain, I was perpetually looking out of a window of the airplane at this stretch of country about which nobody in my family knew very much. And I developed a very early fascination for Central Asia, partly because it always seemed to me a very particular, very unique, and very remote part of the world, quite detached from a lot of the other trends going on in particularly in East Asia. And I became very interested in Islam and in rural Islamic communities.
The other question is why you chose to travel the way that you did, by foot.
I love traveling by foot, partly because I love walking and I love landscape and I love the physical adventure and excitement of crossing a country about which I know nothing, a footstep at a time, feeling the physical sensation of the wind on my face and the slow pace and what that allows me to observe in terms of the landscape. But as I continue with the walk, and I walked on foot from Turkey to Bangladesh, crossing Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal over about 21 months, was the insight that it gave into village culture. I stayed in 500 village houses, sleeping on people's floors, sharing their life. And that, for me, was a really wonderful privilege.
I think that, as you said, people should understand that this was the walk across Afghanistan was part of a larger project that you set out to go from Iran to Nepal, and that you had planned to go through Afghanistan, but at the time, the Taliban was in power. They wouldn't let you. So you did the other parts. And then after the Taliban fell, you decided that you really wanted to go back and do that part that you had not been able to do before.
Exactly. So for me, Afghanistan was an opportunity to connect what I'd experienced of the culture of Iran with what I'd experienced of Pakistan, and to connect really a culture connected with Persian identity and Islam with the culture of India, the culture of South Asia and Hinduism and Buddhism. And Afghanistan is very much on the crossroads of those cultures. Although it's a very remote mountainous place, all historical movements, all invading armies, all religions, all goods in that area traditionally pass through Afghanistan.
And just to be correct here, technically, what you did was you started in Herat, which is over in the eastern part of the country, and you walked, I believe, to Kabul, the capital, and that's almost, that's not quite all the way, but almost, and that perhaps at that point you thought, or as you were approaching Kabul, you thought that given the danger of what you were doing, that you thought perhaps that you would stop there, both because you were concerned that your parents were concerned, and perhaps you yourself thought that in fact there was danger, and maybe it didn't really make sense to actually go from the one border to the other.
Yeah, I had walked from Herat in the west to Kabul in the east, which was a journey which took me about 32 days through the winter. It's the midwinter, and by the time I got to Kabul, I'd had a number of quite threatening experiences. I'd been beaten up by a militia group in Hazarajat, threatened by a Taliban group of young warlord thugs in Wardak, and I had become aware that I was very lucky to make it even as far as Kabul without being killed. So at that point, I decided that it was better to make that the end of my journey.
It certainly seems that your experiences with the people that you met run the gamut from the kinds of things that you just talked about, where you encountered people that would just as soon kill you as look at you. And also at the same time, it seems that you met a lot of people who were unfailingly friendly, kind, gracious, and welcoming. And then perhaps more people were like that than were in the other group that were thinking to themselves, shall I shoot this man or shall I just let him go?
You're right. Basically, 90% of the people I encountered were incredibly generous, dignified, hospitable. And the fact that I made it alive across Afghanistan, or indeed across any of these countries, because I was often, for example, in Western Nepal in Maoist-controlled areas with no central government, no police force, no rule of law, the fact that I made it alive was nothing really to do with me so much as the tribute to the kindness of my hosts and to the villagers. And I really was astonished by the sense that in areas where there were no formal government structures or any formal law, security existed based on a sense of common humanity and the basic ethics of these communities.
I'm sure to some of these people, because you were a Westerner, a non-Muslim and a British citizen, they would have seen you as an enemy. Some people certainly would have. How did people treat you, those people? And I know that you didn't always tell people that that's who you were. For those people who knew that you were all those things, that you were a British citizen, you were a Westerner, you were not a Muslim, how did people treat you?
Well, I think what I found was that rural communities tend to be, certainly in Afghanistan, quite conservative, very concerned with religion and specifically, obviously, with Islam. They were surprised and disturbed that I wasn't a Muslim, often curious to know why I hadn't converted and when I was going to convert to Islam. And balancing in their minds their strong religious obligation of hospitality towards guests with an equally strong instinct that I really ought to be a Muslim and they shouldn't be treating me with the same deference as they would treat a Muslim. So there were times when I found people relatively distant and relatively suspicious, understandably suspicious, because these are remote mountainous regions which don't see many strangers, and even occasionally hostile towards the presence of somebody who they saw as a disturbing force. For example, in some communities, I wasn't allowed into mosques because they thought that I would somehow pollute the mosque, that I was an unclean presence.
Well, I'm sure even for a lot of people who would have taken a different attitude, but would have recognized that you were a foreigner, that you were an outsider, and that you were doing this strange and eccentric thing, that is, you were walking by yourself. The idea was that you're walking by yourself across the country. And I'm sure that when people asked you what you were doing, if you said, well, I have decided that I want to walk across the country, they probably thought that you were crazy. Or at least they would have asked themselves that question, what is wrong with this man? Why is he doing it? And would have difficulty perhaps understanding why it was you would want to do this thing at all.
Absolutely. If they didn't think I was crazy, they'd certainly assume there was some strange agenda which they were having difficulty adjusting to, because again and again people would say, why are you walking? And I'd say, well, you know, I'd start by saying, well, it's the midwinter, so all the roads are closed to cars. There's 6 feet of snow on the road, so there's no alternative other than to walk. To which, you know, understandably, they'd say, yeah, but why do you want to come through this area anyway? Why don't you take one of the lower southern routes where you can take a bus? And then I'd say, well, I'm writing a history book, or I'm interested in rural communities. And at that point, generally, whoever was questioning me would lose interest, because I suppose he would assume that there was something I wasn't saying, or that the situation was somehow, you know, more complex or more sinister than I was implying.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Rory Stewart. If you would like to read the story of this walk across Afghanistan, he has written about it in his book, The Places in Between. It is now out in paperback, published by Harcourt. So you can seek it out in the bookstore. Also, he has a newer book that is about his experiences in post-war Iraq, being part of the reconstruction effort. That book is The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, that is published by Harcourt also. He's joining us by telephone, and questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk and having people who are listening learn a little bit more about your family. Your grandfather lived apparently a good part of his life in India. Is that true?
My grandfather lived more than 50 years of his life in India, and he's much older than me. So my grandfather moved to India in the 1890s and lived there to 1947. And then my father, who's now 84, moved to Asia in about 1945. And lived there till 1997. So really my family have lived, although I'm, you know, ethnically Caucasian and originally from Scotland, my family have really lived in Asia for more than 100 years now.
And your father was in the British Foreign Service?
My father was in the Foreign Service and served in Malaysia. He was the British representative in North Vietnam from 1968 to 1970 during the Vietnam War. And really, his expertise and his interest is more in China.
And you yourself, you served in the British military. Do I have this right? You were actually in the Black Watch?
That's right. I was in the Black Watch briefly, and then the Foreign Service took me out of the Black Watch, and I joined the Foreign Service and served in Indonesia, and then in Yugoslavia, working on Bosnia and Kosovo, and then in Afghanistan before I was posted to Iraq in August 2003.
So by way of your upbringing and your family, you are in more ways than one a true child of the empire, having a kind of experiences many other people, even other Brits, would certainly not have had.
Yes, we're a very bizarre family. I mean, I could continue talking. I mean, really, you know, even my great-grandfather lived outside Britain, so that my house in Scotland, from which I'm talking to you, has really been semi-abandoned for about 150 years because we've always been in other countries.
How does that and having that personal connection to the project of colonialism, how does that shape the way that you think about so many of these places, the kind of places that you talked about, whose modern history truly was shaped by colonialism?
Well, I think, strangely, one of the things that taught me is to be much less romantic about colonialism. I think I'm very convinced that colonialism in the end was a bad, failed, doomed project. That the more I learn about it, and a lot of that is from my father. I mean, my father was, in fact, a colonial officer in Malaya from 1945 to 1957. He was the district officer in Penang and Malacca. From my direct contact with that, I realize, firstly, how very different those societies were from the kind of societies that exist today, that Britain before the war was quite unlike Britain today, but so too a country like Iraq is quite different from what it was in the 1920s. And that's led me to understand that pseudo-colonial projects, and in some ways the projects in Afghanistan and Iraq have echoes of colonialism, are doomed. And they're doomed because our cultures are no longer really comfortable with the idea of colonialism. The individuals in our cultures don't wish to perform these kind of roles. And when we attempt to perform these kind of roles, we fail because the societies in which we're operating, in this case Afghanistan or Iraq, rejects it very strongly, partly because they're very conscious of their own colonial past and they don't wish it to be repeated.
I suppose I mean the United States and Britain have been now, since the invasion of Afghanistan and the fall of the Taliban, engaged in an effort to try to help the Afghan people build a more modern, more democratic nation in the kind of ways that we like to define that. And what I wonder is, you know, given the fact that you spent a lot of time walking across the country and talking with rural people whose political concerns I'm sure would be local and not international, the very idea of trying to build a modern nation and to instill in people the idea that they are citizens of Afghanistan first and whatever their other affiliations would be would kind of come later, whether in fact, when you consider where the vast bulk of the Afghan people are in metaphorical and in actual terms, whether that project seems to make sense, whether it's actually something that is possible.
Well, there are two questions about this project of exporting democracy. First of all, what kind of project is this? What really are the objectives here? Can we define what this means? And that isn't that easy. And secondly, whose project is it? Is this a project which is owned by British and American people, or is it a project which is really owned, led, and believed in by Afghans or Iraqis on the ground? Now, in terms of that first question, what kind of project is this? Well, there is not a single thing called democracy. The kind of democracy that operates in America is quite different from that which operates in Britain or France or Holland or Spain. We all have different models of these things. In broad terms, it's a very attractive vision, and it's one which Afghans and Iraqis would say they share. At least most Afghan and Iraqi rural villages I know want a say in who governs them. They want to vote for their leaders, and they don't want to be dragged from their houses and tortured by secret police. So in that sense, they're very much in favor of human rights. They have a notion of human rights. But once you begin to get away from those generalities down into the details, you're in a much more troubling situation. And that's where our lack of knowledge of local communities, because generally American and British people operating in these societies are unable really to develop a full understanding of local communities, because we're usually there on relatively short-term contracts, a year at most, and restricted by security problems from really traveling out into rural villages. That kind of lack of understanding becomes fatal. So if you ask questions like, do we set up a heavily centralized state in Afghanistan? Do we bring all the power into Kabul? Or do we allow a lot of local autonomy and allow people to vote for provincial governors? Now, the Pashtun want a heavily centralized state. The Hazara want an extremely devolved state in which they control their own affairs and aren't interfered with by this other ethnic group. before you get on to even more controversial issues, such as women. Because one thing that stands in common between remote rural communities in both Afghanistan and Iraq is that the men in those communities have very little interest in women's rights and tend, when left to their own devices without much government interference, to basically systematically repress the rights of women. And so confronted with these kinds of situations and many, many other situations, I mean, questions about whether or not you allow feudal structures to persist, what attitude you take towards religion. I mean, this was made very clear in this case recently where an Afghan converted to Christianity and the Afghan courts announced that he was liable to be sentenced to death for converting from Islam to Christianity. In all these kinds of situations, you suddenly reach a point at which the vision of the people on the ground turns out to be quite different from our vision. And we often don't notice it because often American and British officials, both military and civilian, are dealing with middle-class, educated Iraqis or Afghans in cities. And those people tend to be very, very influenced by Western models, and they tend to tell us what we want to hear. And they tend to write off the rural communities and say, these people are illiterate, they're ignorant, and to say to us, nobody really supports these conservative views, or nobody really is enthusiastic for conservative Islam. Then as soon as the elections are held, as they were in southern Iraq, it turns out that the parties that we're being told have no support get three times as many votes as the next nearest party and take, in the case of the extreme Islamist parties in southern Iraq, 80 or 90% of the vote in the election. And that's when we're really confronted with a problem, because the whole model of bringing democracy to these countries was supposed to be a win-win situation. The vision, I think, of people like Paul Wolfowitz in the Department of Defense was that if you toppled tyrants and you allowed people to vote, necessarily a peaceful, stable, law-abiding, Western-friendly, gender-sensitive, human rights-oriented government would emerge. And that has turned out in the elections not to be the case. What you've ended up with is elected governments who function relatively well as governments but turn out to be often very suspicious and hostile towards the West and very uninterested in many of the aspects of human rights or even the kinds of agendas of peace and stability which we were anticipating.
Well, if you did if you could sit down with the kind of people that you spent a lot of time talking with, rural people, people who not the kind of people who live in the capital, people who make up, I'm sure, really the majority of the population of Afghanistan, and said to them in all sincerity that we, the West, Britain, the United States, Europe, would like to help them to make their lives better. And would they say, or would they just say, just go away and leave us alone?
To be very polite. I mean, I acted as the deputy governor of two provinces in southern Iraq for about 11 months. And mm-hmm. I spent 8-9 hours a day dealing with Iraqis and trying to work out what people wanted and what we were failing to deliver and trying to improve the situation. Partly out of self-interest because I was often surrounded by 3,000 or 4,000 people screaming, get out of our country, Mr. Rory Stewart is a donkey, and ultimately attacking me in my compound. So I was very concerned with this issue of what people wanted and what we could deliver. The answer is generally people are quite polite, and they'll say what we want is security, what we want is jobs, what we want is economic growth. But at the same time, there's another message which they're putting across, which we find difficult to listen to, and that's a message that says, we want to run our own government. We don't want your troops in the street. We want you to do less, not more. And when we'd say to them, well, I mean, is it that you don't like the kind of people that are in government? They'd often respond, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is you chose them. We didn't choose them. And that's our problem with these people. And I think that really, this is quite an understandable problem. I mean, this is the kind of problem that Lewis and Clark encountered on the Upper Missouri in 1805, where Lewis, I mean, almost comically, reads a 2,500-word speech to the Sioux saying, you know, what would you like? You have a new great father in Washington who wants to bring you all these benefits. And the Sioux respond, bring us ammunition, guns, and take very little interest in these grander political visions that Lewis is trying to share. And he is perpetually disappointed that the tribes that he's encountering on the Upper Missouri seem to be suspicious of him and reluctant, resistant to change. Now, of course, I think hopefully over the last 200 years we've learned that there are very good reasons why people are suspicious of outsiders and resistant to change. And I think those things apply as much in Iraq or Afghanistan as they did on the Upper Missouri, because understandably people are thinking, what are you doing in our country? And however much somebody such as myself says, in all good faith, look, you know, I'm here to try to help you. We're here to try to reconstruct the country. I've got $10 million a month to spend in vacuum-sealed packets, and I'd like to create jobs and this, that, and the other. People tend to think, well, hold a second, there's got to be more to it than this, and we're not so sure that we're going to end up better off after this intervention than we were before.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Rory Stewart, and if you would like to read about his experiences working in the post-war reconstruction of Iraq, something that he was involved with for a period of about 10 months, this was in 2003 and 2004, he has written about that in a newly published book, The Prince of the Marshes. And that is published by Harcourt. It's out now in hardcover. And also, if you would like to read the story of his walk across Afghanistan, we talked about that as well, that he has written about in his book, The Places in Between, and it is now out in paper. It's also published by Harcourt. He has written for a number of publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Granta, and the London Review of Books. He's a former fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was awarded the OBE, the Order of the British Empire, by the British government for his services in Iraq. He has served in the British military and in the Foreign Service. And he's talking with us from his home in Scotland. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Stewart, or is it Dr. Stewart?
Definitely Mr. No doctor here.
Okay. In your travels, sir, what did you find the populace opinion of the Imran Nagy government, the communist government, which, at least I understand, was democratically elected? It was a revolution of sorts, and they invited the Soviets in. And well, what are the parallels between that experience and our experience in Afghanistan now? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, this is a very interesting question, and this is something I live in Kabul now. I'm in Scotland only for 3 days visiting my parents. I'm running a foundation in Kabul, and one of the things that I've learned, and it took me a long time to learn, is how much enthusiasm there is still for the old communist government amongst particularly people who live in cities like Kabul or Herat or Jalalabad or Mazar or Kandahar. For them, the communist government represented a period of Western, secular, modernist government. And for many of the city dwellers, they're very distressed by what's followed, particularly the 5 years of civil war that followed the collapse of the communist government. And then, of course, the Taliban period. But even today, they feel that Afghanistan is now run largely by these guerrillas who led the Soviet resistance, the Soviets. And these people are often conservative Islamists, and they're often from tribal, rural backgrounds. So for many educated, upper-middle-class Kabulis, it's a retrogressive step. There are far fewer women now in the workplace than there were under the communist period. And there is an important lesson here for us, which is our version of events, our version of history, is often quite partial. And I thought I knew quite a lot about Afghanistan, but I tended to see it through the prism of the people I knew who were fighting in the resistance against the Soviets. So it's been quite a surprise to me to discover now that I'm working in Kabul, working with the community to try to rebuild the part of the historic city of Kabul, to realize how much enthusiasm there was for the communists at the time.
So as far as the people are concerned, though, if they think back to the communist invasion of the country, and then what has happened since, now the United States did assist the Afghan fighters in driving out the Soviets, with our own agenda in mind. But then we also invaded and toppled the Taliban regime. So do they see some moral equivalence between the Soviet invasion and the American invasion?
I think that the main difference is that the communists became very unpopular with rural communities, largely because they were seen as godless. They were, obviously, communism is an atheist doctrine, and people were offended because the communists often compelled women to uncover their heads, interfered a great deal in male control of the household, and interfered in people's religious and cultural beliefs. So I think the way in which, so far at least, the current coalition invasion has been more popular is that we've tended to steer further off that. We haven't got so involved in trying to micromanage people's religious or cultural beliefs.
I'd like to have you talk perhaps a little bit more, and you have talked some, about the experience in Iraq. This is the subject of the more recent book about your time there working for the British government in the effort to do post-war reconstruction. This was in the southern part of the country, the place where that is the home of the people that are called the Marsh Arabs, people who suffered greatly under Saddam. What moved you to, and again, it's my understanding that what you did was you volunteered to be involved in this work, and it made sense because of your experience doing similar kinds of things. What moved you to step up and say, yes, I would be interested, willing, want to go and be involved in this effort in Iraq after the fall of Saddam?
Well, at the time, I supported the invasion. I now realize that I was wrong, but at the time I strongly believed, having worked in Afghanistan and the Balkans, that people would be better off after the invasion than before. And I thought it was extremely important that we, the United States and Britain, made a success of this intervention in Iraq, that that was in our interest and that it would be in the interest of the Iraqi people. So I thought it was an important task to be done. And I hoped that some of my understanding gained from this 20 months walk across Asia into rural Islamic cultures would be useful. What, of course, I found myself in was an astonishing, bewildering situation, far more complicated than I'd anticipated. 54 new political parties had emerged in the 4 months between the invasion and my arrival, 14 different tribal groups in the province. Even Iraqis struggled to distinguish between these different political parties, to know the difference between Harakat Dawah, Hizbi Dawah Islamiya, Hizbi Dawah Tanzim al-Iraq, which is to say the difference between the movement of the Islamic Call Muslim Party and the Islamic Call Iraq Tendency, which were some of the biggest parties, let alone all the other parties, which often consist of no more than two men in a briefcase with no opinion polls or votes to allow you to really clarify which were powerful, which were effective, which were representative, which were popular. And a gradual realization that fundamentally the operation was doomed because Iraqis were reluctant to cooperate, suspicious of our presence, and very reluctant to take responsibility or take political power or work alongside us to reconstruct the country. And that's what ultimately for me differentiated it from my experience in the Balkans or my experience in Afghanistan or even my experience working on East Timor from Indonesia, where the international intervention was much more popular and where people were prepared to suspend their suspicions and complexities in order to cooperate with the coalition to try to rebuild these countries.
You know, I think that you have explained that at the outset that you favored the war and that your thought was that certainly we could do better than Saddam for the Iraqi people and certainly we could do no worse, and that that turned out not to be the case, and that even though our motivations, that is, the motivations of the West, of Britain, of the United States, were complicated, that at least in our hearts we thought we were doing the right thing and thought we were doing it for the right reason. And what it comes down to is something that we never anticipated, that the people that we were going to help wouldn't automatically recognize our motivations were basically positive. I guess we sort of thought that we could go in there and said, we're here to help you, and they would say, fine. And instead, they said, why? What really do you want? And that things just proceeded to get worse from there. It sounds almost too simple, and yet it does seem to come down to that most basic issue that we thought in our minds it was very clear why we were there, and yet to the people of Iraq, it wasn't clear at all.
Absolutely. And I don't think this is something that could have been overcome just by a better public relations campaign or better communications, or even overcome by spending more money or putting more troops on the ground or not de-Ba'athifying or stopping the looting or any of the things for which the coalition have been criticized. I think the coalition made a lot of very serious mistakes, but they were not decisive, that even if we'd got those things wrong, in the end, this occupation still would have resulted in a mess. And it would have resulted in a mess because Iraqi society, after 35 years of Saddam, was not in a position structurally, emotionally, philosophically to receive this kind of intervention. And that one of the things, you know, which was a real revelation to me was in March 2004, we held an election in a town called Al-Rafai in the north of Dikar in Iraq, and we thought it was a good election with a high turnout, and it elected a council of 10 young men, mostly non-tribal, non-political engineering graduates from Baghdad University. Shortly after they were elected, a militia group of five, led by a young cleric, 28-year-old cleric, marched in and kicked the councillors out of the office, abducted one of them and tortured him. And we asked the Iraqi police to intervene, of whom there were 400 in the town, and they refused, and they refused to take on a militia group of five. And the Italian military went in, and the 28-year-old cleric shot at them, and the Italian military retreated. So we tried to call a political meeting in which the leaders of the community, which in this case meant the headmaster, the imam of the mosques, the sheikhs of the major tribes, the mayor, the police chief were present. And I began by saying, look, this is a disgrace. You know, you had an election that you were proud of. You elected these good young men into the council, and now you've allowed a 28-year-old kid and five men to kick them out. And what are we going to do about this? And the headmaster of the school said, well, you know, maybe we should just hold another election for a new council. And I said, well, there's not much point in doing that. And I turned to the sheikh of the tribe who'd spent 6 months saying, this is a tribal society. Give me guns, I can keep security here, and said, what are you going to do about it? And he said, can't do anything, this guy's not from my tribe. And finally, the imam of the mosque finished by saying, well, this young man's had a difficult life, this cleric. His father died when he was young, can we not just forget about him? The conclusion I took was not that they didn't understand the principles at stake. Everybody understood, you know, why this was not a good situation, but nobody had enough faith in the system or enough willingness to take political responsibility to actually sort it out. And it was at that point that I really realized the way in which this project was doomed.
We have several callers. We have about 10 minutes, and I'll try to get in at least a couple. And for the benefit of everybody else, maybe just quickly I'll introduce again our guest, Rory Stewart. He served in the British Foreign Service and in the military. He's written for a number of publications, New York Times Magazine, Granta, London Review of Books. He has a book that's about his experiences in 2003-2004 in post-war Iraq. That book is The Prince of the Marshes. It's published by Harcourt. And we began by talking about the book The Places in Between, now out in paper, also published by Harcourt, about the time that he spent walking across Afghanistan. We have a number of callers, and we will try to get in as many as we can. Callers can help us if they're brief in their comments. We'll start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Mr. Stewart, I've just begun reading The Places in Between. About 60 pages in, I find it fascinating. A totally non-political question. You've addressed the protocols that these people have for everything, meeting, entering a doorway, where to sit in a room. One thing you haven't addressed, maybe I'm truly in the book yet, I was wondering, should I put it delicately, what about bathroom etiquette? What type of facilities are there, and is there a protocol they've established for that?
Essentially, in rural communities in Afghanistan, there are no bathrooms. There are not even holes dug in the ground. People simply go out in the street in a bigger town, or they go outside the village into the edge of the desert in a smaller village and do their business there. And the protocol is basically that people partially conceal themselves behind whatever happens to be there, a thorn bush or a wall, and everybody else averts their gaze.
And they are so modest, at least in regard to women. I wondered if that was any different for them.
Well, with regard to women, the women tend to try to limit their visits to late at night, and they tend to go much further away from the village and go into small gullies or under a bridge. And, of course, it causes a lot of consternation and social problems if you come across a woman in that situation.
Oh, I see. Well, that was my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The book.
And let's go to next caller. This is Savoy in line two. Hello.
Yeah, I just finished The Places in Between and enjoyed it very much. My question is, have you published the rest of your walking journey?
I haven't yet, because I think it's very difficult for me to work out how to write a book that covers 20 months of travel in 5 different countries and 500 different villages. So I quite like keeping those parts of the journey, for the moment, private to myself, and maybe later when I'm older I'll return to trying to reflect on them.
I'd certainly like to see the part through India and Nepal particularly, but I understand. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Fithian. This is another caller, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was a student in 1977 in England and made friends with a guy in Malaysia, and we went overland through to Malaysia. So it was through Turkey and Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. And this is before the war with the Soviets. And I just wanted to agree with you that the hospitality you receive from the people, the Islamic culture, is just unbelievable. And until you've experienced it, their graciousness is just kind of uncomprehensible. And once we get past all of this, the terrorists and that kind of stuff, once we get at peace with these cultures, it's going to be a really good thing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go back here to Urbana for another caller, line three. Hello.
Hello. Would you comment on my belief that the peace treaty, or the truce, will be ineffective in Lebanon if the Lebanese army has a substantial portion of it, because they are simply associates of Iran and Syria? They saw the infrastructure for war being built up. They heard the missiles. They saw the missiles going off. What did they think they were going to get in return?
Well, that is a little outside of the area that we've been talking about. I don't know. Have you been following events in southern Lebanon?
Well, sir, I mean, I have only visited Lebanon and Israel essentially as a tourist. And I think my really strong belief, what I'm trying to put across in my book on Iraq and Afghanistan, is that these societies are very particular, very local, very unique, very difficult to understand. And so I couldn't really, in all honor, pontificate about it, either Israel or Lebanon, societies about which I have a superficial acquaintance but don't fully understand. I'm trying to say that our main problem in Iraq and Afghanistan is that we come to easy conclusions without fully doing the work on the ground to understand these societies. So I wouldn't want to talk about Israel or Lebanon.
Yeah, a fair response. I hope the caller would understand. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that now you're living in Kabul and that we're now talking with you. You're in Scotland at your family's home, but that is not your home,
at least
not right at the moment.
It's my parents' home.
Your parents' home. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, what that is all about.
Well, this is a foundation which helps the community in central Kabul to help restore a part of the historic city. Under a plan drawn up in 1976, the whole of the historic city of Kabul was supposed to be demolished and replaced with East German concrete architecture. And this small bit that survived on the north bank of the river are traditional courtyard houses with very beautiful wooden facades, which contain within the last traces of 18th and 19th century Afghan and Kabuli culture. And we believe strongly in the community who lives there, believe strongly that this could be a great historic center for the city if we really invest in these buildings and in repairing the area, and that at the same time, we're also investing in a school. We set up a school to train traditional craftsmen who are woodworkers, masons, calligraphers, potters, and trying to support Afghan craft industry and export. So I suppose I've gone from the much more theoretical, abstract politics of my job in Iraq towards a much more concrete, hands-on, smaller-scale project in Afghanistan, and I find it very satisfying, very enjoyable.
Now, you talked earlier about the various places that you have lived, the fact that you really grew up in Asia. You were born in Hong Kong and grew up in Malaysia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that your dad was in the Foreign Service, that he had been in Vietnam as a Foreign Service officer, that your grandfather lived 50 years in India, that your family history in Asia goes back even further, and so that by heritage, perhaps you're a Scot and a British citizen, but that in other ways you have these other kinds of identification. Does that present any kinds of difficulty for you as you're thinking of your own identity and who it is that you are, what you feel that you are?
I think it very much does, and it raises a real problem for us when we operate in Britain or even in the United States. In some ways, I feel more comfortable in somewhere like Afghanistan because I've become very accustomed to the pace of life there, to the extraordinary politenesses and hospitalities of Islamic culture. And I find returning to Britain or even the United States quite abrupt, quite destabilizing. I think modern countries are often very hurried and don't have the time for family relationships and politenesses that you get in I suppose more developing countries. So it is an issue for me, and it puts me also in a difficult position as a British government servant, because of course the more time I spend in these societies, the more sympathy I develop for the people in those societies, and that of course puts me in the classic problem, which is that you end up with the British government almost saying, well, whose side are you on here?
Mm-hmm. You're pretty young now. What do you think about for your future, what you would like to continue to do, where you would like to live? Do you, for example, see at some point going back and living in the house where your parents live?
I'd hope eventually to come home. And there are two things that I'm very interested in. One of them is writing, and I think it's very important to write and to think about prose and to think about how to record and preserve ideas from our culture. And the second thing is politics. I am very interested in the way in which societies can come together, the way in which we can change things. I'd like to work either in the United States or Britain with Islamic communities and to look at ways to try to resolve some of the problems that seem to be emerging at the moment.
We're almost out of time, and I realize that it's unfair to ask a question like this at the end, but as far as Iraq is concerned, we have a huge body of evidence now that what we did there was poorly done, was poorly conceived. We made many mistakes, and perhaps almost whatever we had done, it would not have turned out well. Now we're there, and a lot of people who feel that even it was a mistake to go in the first place, that it's like what Colin Powell said, you know, we broke it, we bought it, we're responsible, and that we're going to be there for some time to come. How do you think this gets resolved, and is this something that just is going to play out very slowly and painfully over another 5 or 10 years, or who knows how long?
That's not my view. My view is that we should get out as soon as possible, that we need to hand over to Iraqi politicians, empower them, that what is on the edge of being a civil war at the moment can only be resolved through political negotiation, and that's negotiation that can be only done by Iraqis, that we have neither the skills or the resources or the legitimacy to resolve this burgeoning civil war. And that so long as we remain there, we are exacerbating the situation and we're not contributing to its amelioration or improvement. So I think we need to get away from what I think is a patronizing and arrogant attitude, which is the attitude that says, if we're not there, everything's going to collapse. My instinct is that if we really allowed Iraq to get on with it, they would be able to resolve these situations, but we'd have to accept that they'd resolve it in an Iraqi way.
Hmm. Our guest, Rory Stewart, his books are The Prince of the Marshes and The Places in Between, published by Harcourt. He's also written for The New York Times Magazine, Granta, the London Review of Books. Mr. Stewart, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.